good. Okay, open your Bibles up to the book of Daniel, if you would. In particular, we're going to be looking at page 619 if you're using the Bible that we have been handing out in the book of Daniel. If you need a Bible, raise your hand. We'd love to bring one to you. And again, it's page 619 that we're going to be looking at there in the book of Daniel. So we're in this series. This is the fifth sermon in the series called In the Meantime. And we are studying what it means to live in the meantime, in a middle time in your life, in between something that was very significant that happened and maybe waiting for the next significant thing to happen in your life. Daniel was kind of the master, the model of this. Daniel was taken away from his homeland in Israel and taken away to Babylonia. And he was kept there for a number of years, waiting to be returned back to Israel. And the book of Daniel is really the story of his life in this foreign land, waiting to go back to his homeland. So he's a perfect model of somebody who lives in the meantime, and difficult things happen. And as we kind of go through this story, we learn what it means to live faithfully in the meantime. And it's been neat how a lot of you have come up to me and said, you know, I'm in the meantime right now. I'm looking for a job, or I finished this, or you know, I'm waiting for God to work in my life in a special way. I'm looking for a kind of a transformation. It used to be that my walk with the Lord was really vibrant, and I just feel like I'm in a dry time right now. I'm waiting for that to come back around. I'm in a broken relationship situation that I'm looking for some sort of healing, and I'm just waiting. I've been waiting for a long time. I feel like I'm just in the meantime. And all of us can know what it means to be in the meantime. We have a acute sense of what it means to experience that. And so the lessons of Daniel are really valuable to us and important to us. And in fact, all of us essentially are living in the meantime on kind of a large scale. I mean, if we take the Christian worldview, if we understand what it means to be a follower of Christ, we understand that this time frame in world history right now is really a meantime. It's a middle time. Because Jesus has come, and he lived on the earth, and he died, and he was crucified, and he was raised from the dead. And we're told that he's coming back. We don't know exactly when that's going to happen, but we're waiting for that day, and we're living the way that God has called us to live as he helps us and empowers us in that meantime, waiting for Jesus to come back. So this concept applies to all levels of our lives, and sometimes it's surprising to see what God would have us reflect on in the meantime. And this morning, the topic that we're going to look at is a little bit surprising in that way. And what I mean is this, is that one of the important things for us in terms of living in the meantime is to have a healthy sense of God's holiness. To have a healthy sense of God's holiness. This is what our text is going to lead us to this morning. And you might not think that that's necessarily the case, but we're going to find out that it's true. John Piper, who's a pastor back in Minnesota, was one time preaching, and he said, he's going into the pulpit to preach a sermon. He thought, I'm going to preach this sermon on God's holiness, and I'm not going to give any application for the congregation, for the people. Application is when you say, okay, here's what God says. Now, let's get into the nitty-gritty details of how exactly it's to play out in our lives. And he didn't give any application on this particular Sunday. He just said, I'm going to talk about God's holiness and kind of let the chips fall wherever they fall. Well, on that morning, there happened to be a family sitting right there in the front who had just discovered that one of their precious children was being sexually abused by one of their relatives. And so they listened to this sermon. You would think, more than anybody, what they needed at that time was practical application, right, for their lives, how to get through the next day. Well, several weeks later, this father of this family came up to the pastor, John Piper, and he said, you know what? This horrible thing has happened to us. We just discovered that one of our children has been abused in this way. And it's been several weeks now. And I just want to tell you this. The thing that has gotten us through this incredibly difficult meantime in our lives right now is that vision of God's holiness that you gave to us several weeks back. No application, just a vision, a deep understanding of God's holiness. That's what got them through. And we're going to find a similar kind of thing this morning, that God's holiness is really critical to the mean times of our lives, to getting through. So look with me. We're going to start in Daniel chapter 5, starting in verse 1. And I would like to unfold some of these things as I read it. We're going to explain what holiness means. We're going to think about how we are going to talk a little bit about application to our lives this morning. But first of all, let's look at the text. Let's let this text kind of bring up this subject and shape our thinking for it a little bit. Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. And let me just pause there and give us a little bit of a background. We're jumping right in here. Now, King Belshazzar, who's that? We haven't heard of this guy so far in a study in the book of Daniel. King Belshazzar is the son of the fourth ruler after Nebuchadnezzar. We've been learning so much about Nebuchadnezzar. And after Nebuchadnezzar, there were all kinds of other rulers who had very short stints. And then the fourth one comes along. And Belshazzar is actually the son of this king. The king, the father is off fighting wars in Arabia for 10 years. And so what happens in that kind of thing is the son then gets to take charge. And so he's in charge of the Babylonian at that time. And this is 66 years after the beginning of the book, when Daniel first was taken away in exile. So to just give you a time frame. So Daniel, as we've skipped ahead a lot. Daniel's probably in his 80s at this point. So he's been waiting for a long time, right, to be restored back to Israel. This is a serious mean time that he's been in. And this is a critical point to our understanding of this text. As Belshazzar is sitting there, he's throwing this banquet, this party, there is another nation, or actually combination of nations, the Medes and the Persians, who are essentially on the doorstep of Babylonia, ready to come crashing in, invade, and take over. And this is known to them and explains partly what's going on here in the text. So that's kind of the setting. And he calls this banquet. And in 1899, in Babylonia, they excavated the banquet room where this would have taken place. And it was a room, it was about 3,000 square feet. So it was a huge room. And this king, Belshazzar, he brings all of the rulers and everybody together in this room to kind of throw a party. Now, we know that the Medo-Persians are just right on the doorstep, ready to invade Babylonia. And so you have to ask the question, why is he throwing this party at this time? You know, what's going on? And we don't really know, but probably, you know, it's kind of the attitude of, you know, let's eat and drink and be merry because tomorrow we die. Right? Tomorrow we die. He knows what's going to be coming down the pike. So that's kind of the setting of what's happening here. Verse 2, while Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. Now, remind you, those of you who were here when we first started the book of Daniel, remember it starts off, the very beginning, with Nebuchadnezzar crashing in and taking away the goblets and the golden temple items that were used in the worship in the temple in Israel. And so they've been sitting for all these years in Babylonia, and just kind of nobody's using them, I guess. I mean, we don't have any word of Nebuchadnezzar ever doing anything like this. And here's this Belshazzar, and he's partying away, and in the midst of his party, he says, you know what, bring the goblets, the gold goblets from the temple, and we're going to drink out of them. Now, we got to understand something about the history of those goblets. God had been teaching the Jews throughout history something, a powerful sense of the difference between holy and profane, holy and unholy. You know, some things were holy and some things were not. And this process sort of culminated in the establishment of the temple. And God was believed to dwell in the temple itself. And so it was a very holy place. And there were all these levels of the temple. Like if you were way on the outside, you know, everybody could stand out there. But only certain people could go into the next level. And then a smaller group of people were allowed to go into the next level. And then even a smaller group allowed to go into the next level after that. Until finally you got into the very inner sanctuary of the temple. And there was only one person who was allowed to go in the inner sanctuary of the temple once a year, and that was the high priest, because it was such a holy place. It was so sacred. And the story goes that when that high priest would go in there, we don't know if this actually happened for sure or not, it's kind of a tradition, there would be a rope attached to his leg, because what happens if, you know, God decided to smite him, you know, while he's in there? How would you get this body out? You wouldn't want this body in there decaying in the Holy of Holies. So they would put this rope on this guy, you know, and they'd just yank him out if something happened to him while he was in the middle there. And so God had been teaching this concept of holy and profane, holy and unholy. There are things that are holy, sacred, set apart, special, and there are things that are profane that are not set apart, not sacred, and not so special. And these goblets were of the very holiest kind. They were from the temple. They were used in the sacred services of worship in the temple. And so it strikes us as incredibly amazing that this Belshazzar would take these goblets and just, you know, gather all his friends together and, you know, crack open the two-buck chuck and just start partying with these goblets from the temple. In fact, it gets worse than this. If you look in the next verse 4, it says, as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Not only did they use these goblets to drink in sort of a profane way, but they worshipped other gods. You know, the very first commandment was that, you know, God should be the only one who would be worshipped, the God of Israel. And so here they're using these goblets, actually toasting other gods in a kind of a form of idolatry. Well, this goes on for just a short bit, it seems. In verse 5, suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. Now, it's interesting to note that not only was there some writing going on the wall, but there must have been sort of some sort of spiritual sensation that went along with that writing. In other words, he's filled with terror. And as we find out, he doesn't even know what the words are saying. So it's not that the words themselves fill him with terror at this point, that there's something going on. There's something going on that is beyond what he can understand. It's a spiritual kind of a terror. And we find this to be the case all throughout Scripture. When somebody comes into contact with the holy God, there is a sense of awe, a sense of reverence, and a sense of terror, in fact. And this is what we see. Verse 7, the king called out to the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck. And he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. It's like a typical king. He figures that I can buy myself out of this circumstance, right? I just have enough money. I'll pay somebody to figure this thing out. Verse 8, then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. Now, they probably understood the letters because when Daniel comes, what he reads are common words that would have been understood. But in those days, they wrote in such a way that there were no gaps and there would be many different ways to read those letters. And as they looked at it, they couldn't make sense of which words they were to be reading in this. And when they did read the words, they didn't know what it meant. They couldn't interpret what this meant. Then the king's wise men came in and they couldn't read it. Verse 9, so the king Belshazzar became even more terrified and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. Now, whenever somebody comes into the banquet hall, that's what they say about the king. But this queen, we don't know who it was. There's two possibilities. This could have been the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, who actually lived to the ripe age of 104, or it could have been the Belshazzar's mom, and it's not clear who it was. But whoever it was, this is the key point. This woman who comes in has what Belshazzar does not have, and that's a sense of memory. She remembers Daniel, she remembers the God of Daniel, and she remembers the interactions that take place between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and this God. Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom, she says, who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? Now, it's interesting to note the way that Belshazzar talks to Daniel. He's a little bit condescending. He reminds everybody in the banquet hall and that right then that Daniel's in exile. He's just a lowly exile that's been brought by one of his forebears, Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 14, I have heard, he wants to make no commitments to his belief in Daniel or his God. I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." You can see there's kind of a coldness on Daniel's part as well towards this king Belshazzar. There's nothing like his approach to Nebuchadnezzar, where there was this relationship of at least some measure of respect. Now, there's a pause here in the text. Before Daniel interprets what that writing meant that brought so much terror and wasn't understandable, he takes the opportunity to give Belshazzar some advice. And this is what prophets always did. As you read through the Old Testament, you see this over and over again. He gives them some advice. He says, "O king," verse 18, "the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you," Daniel says, "you, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself. Though you knew all this, instead you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription." In other words, the point that Daniel makes here for Belshazzar is, look, you know the history. You know this God. You watched as this God interacted with Nebuchadnezzar and brought him to his knees. You should have known better than to treat what is sacred as profane. You should have known. You can't plead ignorance in this case. This is not a question of you running out of goblets and looking for extra goblets. You knew who this God is, and you should have responded in the proper way. You should have known. And then he goes to interpret this inscription. Verse 25, this is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. Very interesting. Numbered, numbered, is what it says. Weighed, divided. Numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. These are words that would be used for measurement in the context of measuring things. This is what these words mean, says. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. And by the way, this is really interesting. A lot of these sayings that we use, like your days are numbered, comes from here, right? And that we've already talked about a couple of other ones. The handwriting is on the wall comes from this chapter, right? And then a couple chapters before, everybody has clay feet. You've heard that saying before. Comes from the book of Daniel. So, I mean, there's a lot of powerful stuff that's really worked its way into our culture here. Here's another one. Anyway, this first one means that your days are numbered. Verse 27, tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. And Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And there's a couple of different ways that the pointing can go, and it could also mean that this last word, Perez, could refer to the Persians as well. That word could be translated Persians, also divided or Persians. And so there's a lot of different levels going on here in terms of inscriptions regarding what God is doing right now in this time. Verse 29, then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Now, he said he wasn't going to take those, right? And we don't know why he did. Probably he knows what's going on, what's going to be happening next in the kingdom, that the Medes and the Persians are standing at the door ready to come crashing in. And verse 30, look what happens. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, I find it absolutely fascinating that this happened. We know this from the annals outside of the Bible, that this happened on the night that the constellation of Libra would rise, its annual rise. Anybody know what the symbol is for Libra, the constellation of Libra? The scales, right? So it's the weighing and dividing thing. So God was obviously making a very powerful point when looking at Belshazzar on that evening. Okay, so I want to pull out one particular theme, as I've already talked about. We've been saying this over and over again. The book of Daniel is not about Daniel. It's not about Nebuchadnezzar. It's not about Belshazzar. It's about God. The book of Daniel is about God. And the point in this chapter that I want to draw out is God's holiness. You can't read this chapter and walk away without recognizing the holiness of God and the strength of it. Talk about God's holiness. Let's do a little defining here. To be holy means to be separate, to be apart from, to be other. But it's not separate in just kind of a one thing is over here, one thing is over here way. It's separate in the sense of above, better, actually, morally superior. And there's some things about God's holiness that sometimes we don't enjoy so much. God's holiness isn't satisfied with just being separate and apart from others. It carries with it a kind of an intolerance to the unholiness in the other things around it. That's not a word we like very much, but God's holiness is fundamentally intolerant of the lesser. And not only is it intolerant, but it actively works towards purifying that which is not pure. It reaches out to bring purity in the places where there's a lack of purity. It's not just intolerant and doesn't just sit back, but it's active. It's participating in bringing about purification. So it's intolerant, it purifies, and it gives us all this kind of a sense of hierarchy, another word that we don't like, especially in our day and age. God is above. He's better. He's on a different plane. He's other. And we are below. We are not perfect. We are not superior. We are not God. And so his holiness is not just being separate. It's this levels that it brings. And it comes with this attitude of bringing subservience to people. When we see in Scripture over and over again, people who encounter the holiness of God, they bow down and they say, "I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy." You know, we joke about that in our day and age, right? That's a really funny thing to think about. But they weren't joking. And these were righteous people who, if they were to compare themselves to the people around them, they were much more pure, much more righteous, much better. And when they encountered the holiness of God, they were broken and brought to their knees. They said, "Get away from me. I'm not worthy to be in your presence." So holiness means separate, but it's a special kind of a separation. It's a separation between two things that are on different planes, and one is superior to the other. And because of this, you know, I mean, this is really, isn't this sort of opposite to the way our culture thinks these days, usually? This whole concept of holiness. And we like to say that it's all good. Nobody's better than anybody else. You know, everything's okay. Nothing is bad or evil or impure. Everything is acceptable, and it's fine. You know, the Bible projects a very different worldview for us around this topic of holiness. But because it is kind of a term like this, it's not our favorite, oftentimes. Holiness is not one that we gravitate to. Not something that we like to talk about. And I can understand this to a certain degree. Some of us have had bad experiences, you know, with the concept of holiness. We've maybe grown up under kind of a hellfire and brimstone sort of preaching style where it seems like the only thing true about God is that he's holy and nothing else matters. And week in and week out, we're pounded with this sense of God's holiness. And it kind of shapes us in the wrong way, and we get too full of it. We can't understand it. And sometimes when it's misunderstood, it leads to a kind of a legalism. This holiness of God leads to a kind of a legalism where we try to make people be holy. We kind of put laws on their lives. We say, "You better do this. If you don't do this,
you know, I'm going to keep you accountable and make sure it doesn't happen. And we descend into this kind of a legalism. I had an interesting interchange with Kevin Peet this week over this topic, and we were kind of going back and forth. And, you know, there's kind of a spiritual somberness that comes in communities where the only focus is on holiness. And he reminded me of a statement that a Puritan is described as someone who's desperately afraid that someone somewhere is having fun, you know. And kind of the spiritual somberness that come upon us when we focus exclusively on the holiness of God. And then there's another aspect which Kevin also brought out, which I think is really important. And that is that sometimes we shy away from thinking and talking about God's holiness because the light of his holiness is too bright. And we're filled with darkness. And we don't like darkness. And we don't like to have the light shining in our darkness. That's scary. And so we shy away from the topic of God's holiness because we don't want to have that bright light shining into the corners and the crevices of our lives. Sometimes we shy away from thinking and writing and talking about holiness because there is an aspect of humbling that has to be a part of our understanding of holiness. If we're gonna agree that God is holy, then there's going to be a humbling that takes place in us. Because if we compare ourselves to the people around us, you know, maybe we can kid ourselves and say, you know, well, I'm better than so-and-so, or I'm okay. But when we compare ourselves to God, we see how desperately short we fall. There is an otherness, a standard that's so much higher and so much greater. And that's a humbling thing. And the honest truth is that few of us enjoy being humbled. We like to exalt ourselves. It feels good. Humbling ourselves doesn't feel good. And so we shy away from thinking and reflecting on God's holiness. And then for some of us, we have a hard time with God's holiness because his holiness appears to contradict his love. And the classic example of this is when we go to the Old Testament, we look at the holy wars, the wars that Israel fought, that were aimed at rooting out the unholy nations in the land that they were to take over. And we look at the God who would call people to do that, and then we have this sort of picture of the New Testament, and really it's not quite accurate, but we think that the New Testament portrays this God who is all just loving and kind, and Jesus in his sweetest moments all the time. Of course, we're bracketing out a lot of Jesus when we do that, because Jesus was in fact very much concerned with holiness, and he spoke very powerfully about this subject. But we kind of get in our minds the separation of the two, and we go, well, I can't see how they're reconciled, and so I'm going to jettison this concept of holiness. I'm going to embrace the God of love, and that's what I'm going to focus on. And so the holiness of God is diminished in our minds. And I can understand this, and I wrestle with this myself. But at the end of the day, we have to come to terms with the fact that if we take away holiness from the God of the Bible, even if we diminish holiness of the God of the Bible, then he's no longer the God of the Bible. We've created a straw man, somebody in our own image that we would like to have. And this is true whether you're looking in the Old Testament or the New Testament. The fact of the matter is that God is holy. It's a little bit like if you were to say, you know, I don't like the fact that metal is hard because I don't like the prospect of being hit by a car. Now, the reality is that metal is, in fact, hard. And your wishing it were other will not change the hardness of metal. It's the way it is. And you're best served to adapting your life to that reality rather than wishing it would go away. And not running out in front of cars that are hard because they're made of metal. Cars are metal and they're hard. God is holy. He's other. He's separate. He's intolerant of sin and unholiness. That's just the way it is. Now, I find it helpful to think about what would we lose if we diminished the concept of God's holiness. What do we lose if we diminished our understanding of God's holiness? On one level, you really can't even imagine a world
without a holy God. So many things would be different. You know, if you pull out that one block, the whole edifice kind of comes crumbling down. You can't even imagine such a world. But let's just try. Let's just kind of play with it here a little bit. If God were not holy, if his holiness were diminished, then there would be no check against evil in the world. Would there? There'd be no check against evil in the world. Imagine a world where evil runs completely rampant. Secondly, there would be no hope of justice in the world. There'd be no hope of justice because there'd be no check against evil. There'd be no such thing as justice. And how would people respond in a world where there is no justice? There'd be no possibility of heaven because there'd be no place where God's intolerance of sin is fully expressed such that there is no sin. It's a pure place. There'd be no heaven if God were not holy. There'd be no reason for the death of Christ. And if there were no reason for the death of Christ, there'd be no depth to our understanding of God's love. It would be significantly diminished. And if there were no depth to our understanding of God's love, there would be human love would reflect that same poverty. We could go on and on. If you pull out the block, the building block of holiness, in many respects, the entire edifice of this world begins to crumble. You know, it'd be nice if cars weren't metal, right? Because when they hit us, we wouldn't get hurt. But then again, if a car weren't metal, it wouldn't go anywhere at all, would it? It'd just be a lump of goo sitting in your driveway. See, if you take this critical piece out, then the whole thing crumbles. The universe doesn't make sense anymore. And so it behooves us to come to grips with God's holiness. In fact, the more we dive into it, the more we understand, the more we grasp it, the more we can align ourselves with the one who's called us and equipped us and loved us. So that's what I want to do for just a few moments here as we finish up. I've made an apology for holiness and for not diminishing our understanding of holiness. And now I want to just say a couple things about how we ought to be letting God's holiness shape us, flow out of this text that we've been looking at. First of all, is in our coming to faith. Really, you can't begin a relationship with God without a sense of his holiness. You cannot begin a relationship with God without a sense of his holiness. We must grasp that there is an other way to live. That people in this world live one way, but it's not perfect. And that I live a particular way, and I'm not perfect. If we don't grasp that, then we can't initiate the process of coming to God. If we do grasp it, all of a sudden we see the poverty of the people around us, we see the poverty in ourselves, and now we can start to look for a solution to the problem. And we'll look around, we'll check out different religions, we'll check out different teachings, and we can go through that whole process, and eventually where we'll end up is there's only one place where we can go to solve the problem of our lack of holiness and God's holiness. And that's in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ brings together human flesh and holiness. And for those of us who can't do that, he goes to the cross. And he dies as a sacrifice that brings cleansing to those of us who are unholy, but who are willing to accept that sacrifice as applied to our lives. And that marks the beginning of a relationship with God. And we cannot have it without a deep, profound understanding of God's holiness. It's critical to our coming to faith. But it's critical for the time afterwards too. It's critical for our living by faith. If we want to truly live by faith, then we can't have a diminished sense of God's holiness in any way. Think about Belshazzar as he was drinking that cup of wine out of that sacred vessel that he was holding. And ask yourself the question, well, what's sacred for us, right? I mean, we don't have the temple, and we don't have those sacred cups that we have to be careful of, right? So we flip forward to the New Testament, we ask the question, what's sacred for us? You know, what do we have to be careful that we treat it as though it's holy? And what you find statements like Jesus saying that no longer is worship going to be, you know, isolated to this one particular place. But worship is in spirit and truth. It's wherever you are.
other words, worship is possible wherever you are. You find statements where it says that you are the temple of God. And the congregation, the body of Christ, is the temple of the Holy Spirit. So the question isn't, okay, now since we don't have the temple, we don't have the goblets, nothing is sacred. That's not how you answer that question. What you understand is that everything is sacred now. In fact, the saying goes that there's not one square inch in this universe about which God doesn't declare, it is mine. And then we ask the question, do we ever treat any of those things profanely? Do we ever take what God has intended to be holy and treat it in a way that it's not supposed to be treated? Now, a lot of you are nodding your heads, and you're saying, yes, we do. And there's a remedy for that. It's Jesus Christ, right? And we have that remedy for when we fail, when we mistreat the people around us, when we take the goblet and use it profanely. We have this remedy, Jesus Christ. But then I want to say this. Jesus Christ is the most sacred vessel of all. And then, you know, I read this the first time, and I'm thinking of Belshazzar, and you know, this grimy king who never took a bath, and he's all partying with all his concubines and all this stuff, and he's swearing in Aramaic and, you know, worshiping this god and that god, and just a character that just has nothing to, you know, endear him to us. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking of him grabbing that precious goblet that, you know, only sat in the temple, and it's gold, and it had all these sacredness to it, and he's putting in his two-buck chuck, and he's, you know, drinking this down and toasting his friends, and I'm just saying, ah, what a fool. You know, what a jerk. I can't believe that guy would do that. And then I get to the end of my studies, and I start to think about myself. What's my goblet? It's everything that God has placed in my path that's his. And when I mess up with that stuff, it's his son, Jesus Christ. And if I'm honest with myself, I'm no different than Belshazzar. Sometimes I sin with a high hand and I say, oh, it's okay, I got Christ. It's okay, I got Christ. Forgive me. And in that moment, I am no different from Belshazzar. Because I am taking the most sacred cup, the holiest vessel, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, and using him in a profane way, taking that cup for granted. The only thing different is that somehow by God's grace, I'm not condemned because of it. Whereas Belshazzar is. The Persians come crashing in that very night and he dies. And I'm standing here in front of you this morning, breathing miraculously, when I probably shouldn't be. And the point is not to make us feel guilty. The point is to cause us to cherish the cup of Christ. And to let that high sense of the value of it shape our actions. Cause us to pause when we think we're just going to run over God's ways and his people and his creation, and everything sacred that's been put in our path. Do we want to be like Belshazzar, drinking that cup, profaning it? And I just want to ask you this morning to think that question. What am I doing? In what way am I living such that I'm taking for granted
the cross of Jesus Christ. Be really clear about this. You cannot run to the cross too fast after you sin. The moment you sin, you run to the cross. You cannot go too fast. You're forgiven right now. You can't go there too fast. But you can take it for granted. You can sin high-handedly and say, oh, I got the cross. It doesn't matter. I'm okay. I'll be fine. I'm covered. And in that moment, you are Belshazzar. I am Belshazzar drinking the cup.